to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest is a New York Times bestselling author, historian, and award-winning journalist, and author of 7 books that have been translated into a dozen languages and inspired an NBC television drama. Colin Woodard is a longtime foreign correspondent and reported from more than 50 countries on 7 continents. He was a finalist for a 2016 Pulitzer Prize. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Politico, the Washington Post, The Economist, and many other major publications. He is author of American Nations and now has a new book, Nations Apart, How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. Colin Woodard, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
And you, in your book, you try to make sense of these regional divides in North America and this country in particular. And I think people will be surprised that you give us information that we didn't learn in our history classes. Oh, my goodness. I was amazed at my emotional reaction to much of what you wrote. I mean, you back it up with statistics, but I found myself getting angry at some points. And so I just...
Probably a healthy reaction. Yeah.
Yes, I think so. I do think so. So you talk about what democracy is, and you have your own definition. And you say that America's democracy is collapsing. You say, part of me can't believe I'm writing those words, even though I've spent the past 2 decades engaged in the struggle to protect it, but they're true. And I found that same thing true for me. When you say America's democracy is collapsing, I can't believe that I'm agreeing with you. Would you just read the first 3 paragraphs in your introduction, Colin?
Absolutely. Democratic collapses, like bankruptcies, happen gradually and then all at once. So do collapses of countries. Americans are experiencing what it's like when both are happening at the same time. The United States is an awkward federation of distinct regional cultures created as an ad hoc alliance to resist a common British opponent. At the moment of this creation, a handful of the most eloquent founders proposed its ideals: to create a place where all people could live in freedom. We've been fighting over those ideals ever since. Yet, ironically, they are the one thing that can hold us together. To achieve these ideals, Americans fought for and slowly built a liberal democracy, a form of government where people have both civil and political rights. Across a large swath of the country, this required a revolution, the civil rights movement of the 1960s, to overthrow what had been illiberal, authoritarian regimes under which a person's rights depended on their bloodlines. When those former Confederate states became liberal democracies, America finally did too.
And you, in the next sentence, say, now, that's all coming apart. And that's the pretty much the title of your book. My guest is Colin Woodard, and his book is Nations Apart, How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. And people might think, what, nations? There's an S on that word? We are a nation. I think that's what listeners would assume. But you put an S on nations. And you even give us different labels for what we think of as a nation. What are some of the labels that you assign to what we would call a nation?
Yeah, correct. This is, I mean, we're really a federation of stateless nations, if you will, regional cultures that have a lot of aspects of nationhood. And that, you know, understanding that is essential to understanding the fractured character of our federation, why we have red states and blue states, why we fought a civil war, and all of the rest. And these terms, this all comes from a previous book, American Nations, which came out in 2011. And Nations Apart takes that and runs with the implications for today through data analysis and the like. And the nations each trace back to one or another of the rival colonial projects that settled the eastern and southwestern rims of what's now the United States. And those are, you know, Yankeedom, which is ties back to the early Puritans coming to New England and Massachusetts, people who thought themselves in a covenanted relationship with God, like the biblical Hebrews, and they thought they'd been tasked to create a utopia, and they had to do it, you know, together as a group through shared institutions. They'd be punished or rewarded as a group if anyone messed up. So the mission was the most important thing, confidence in institutions and the like, and it spans from New England across the places that New Englanders and their descendants first colonized: the upstate of New York, the Western Reserve of Connecticut and the northern part of Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and bits of other states. And then there's, you know, if you go down further south from there, there's an area around New York City that was founded by the Dutch. I call it New Netherland. It's an area that its Dutch roots from the 1600s, from the time when the Netherlands and Amsterdam were the most sophisticated societies in the probably in the entire world, that had global trading states, great tolerance for diversity, freedom of inquiry and conscience. And that was what, from the time New York City, from the time New Amsterdam was a tiny village, those were the characteristics of that area, that colony. And even after the English takeover in the late 1670s, it's retained a lot of those characteristics: commercial, multicultural, multi-ethnic, not concerned with great moral questions like the Yankee New Englanders to their north. And then you go further south from there, you run into the Tidewater, which is was established by the second, third, fourth, fifth sons of the English country gentry families. In other words, the sons who were not going to inherit the manor estate at home. But when the New World was discovered, they realized that, oh, we could create our own Downton Abbeys and, you know, set up our own estates in the Virginia and Maryland Tidewater country. So it's conservative society trying to recreate the world that they had left in the English countryside: aristocratic, stratified, kind of like Downton Abbey, if you imagine it in the 17th century instead of the early 20th. And you know, there's the Deep South, which was founded by English planters from Barbados, who had created a West Indies-style, fully, you know, fledged slave, plantation economy. And when they ran out of room in Barbados in the 1670s, transplanted that model to the new colony in the Carolinas and the subtropical lowlands of the continent. There's the area settled, including the southern part of California, settled south to north by New Spain, and has completely different characteristics than elsewhere. Includes a large section of the Southwest, not the parts just claimed on paper, but the parts actually colonized, boots on the ground, prior to the U.S. annexations. There's the left coast, I call it. It's a Chile-shaped, you know, strip of a nation running south to north from approximately Monterey, California, all the way up through Juneau, Alaska, between sandwiched between the mountains and the sea. It was colonized primarily by Yankee New Englanders, and then by a separate stream coming overland from the Appalachian parts of the lower Great Lakes states. And it's a particular society, very different from the interior of California or Oregon or Washington or British Columbia or much of Alaska, which was settled with a completely different model by totally different people. And you can see that reflected on county level maps of most anything in those states and provinces, including elections or, you know, the contours of the Calexit movement and so on. So there are states, you know, there are other regional cultures as well that we could describe, but the central thing to understand is that each one is traced back to a particular rival colonial project with particular characteristics, and that over time, those founding characteristics have managed to be transmitted all the way to the present day. And you can see, once you know the contours of these settlement patterns, these great tectonic plates of our history and politics, you see them reflected in county level mapping of most everything, from hotly contested elections to COVID vaccination and death rates, diabetes rates, obesity, FICO credit scores, life expectancy, gun violence. One could go on and on, but it's the decoder ring to really understand the contours of this country, its history, and the phenomenon we experience.
This is New York Times bestselling author Colin Woodard. And what he's actually describing is a map in the very front of his book. Before he even gets to the introduction, he shows us a map of what he's been describing, these various nations. We think of ourselves as one nation. And I found so much of what I read was personal for me. I learned more about myself in reading your book and studying your maps, Colin. And for example, this map you have in the very front, I acquired my last name by marrying what I thought was a Midwesterner. And it was of German origin, my last name that I kept. But I looked at your map and saw, oh, the northern part of Indiana, you label Midlands, and the southern part, where he was born in middle of Indiana, mm-hmm. is Greater Appalachia. And I was shocked by how what a large area that covers. I think of Appalachia as the mountains over.
Yeah, that's the core, but the greater is much larger than that. Because the people who settled Appalachia, that they arrived first in the what was then the Pennsylvania frontier. There's another society called the Midlands that you mentioned that was founded by William Penn and the Quakers. They were culturally pluralistic with no one group in charge. And Quakers also believed that in an inner light, that humans are inherently good. And one of the effects of that is they had a really open immigration policy. So they let all sorts of people of different religions and ethnicities come into their colony from the beginning. And the largest group to come at first was this Scots-Irish and Lowland Scots and people from the English marches from the war-torn areas of the British Isles. And huge numbers came. They went to South Central Pennsylvania and they spread into what we think of as Appalachia. But beyond that, too, that the colonization stream went all the way down what was called the Great Wagon Road down to colonize the upland parts, the interior parts of Virginia, what's now West Virginia, the western parts of North Carolina, much of Tennessee, northern Alabama, northern Georgia, on into the Ozarks, and even down to the Texas Hill Country. And another branch on the other side of the mountains went into Kentucky and then rafted down the Ohio River to colonize the southern parts of the lower Great Lakes states, Ohio, Indiana, like you mentioned, Illinois down by Cairo, Little Dixie, and other parts of Missouri. And then on out, playing out over a vast area. So it's actually the largest of all the regional cultures, both in population and in land area for anything touching on the lower 48 states. So you're correct in that there were many Germans in the Midlands. Also characteristic in the Appalachian settlement streams were little clots and enclaves of Germans within that Scots-Irish dominated settlement stream who usually settled their own towns, usually with German names, which is where you get places like Germantown and what's now Shepherdstown, West Virginia, and other places colonized by Germans within that. So yeah, that description of your family history would seem to match. And Indiana and its politics are, and even its nickname, the Hoosiers, are all linked to that. that's Scots-Irish / Lowland Scots / English March's founding heritage.
Well, I am amused by the fact that when I run into somebody from Cincinnati and they don't understand something I say or that you say, and instead of saying, oh, I beg your pardon, could you repeat that? You know what they say? Translation from the German, they say, please, bitte, bitte.
Right, you're right.
And so they give away their German origins with that one word in my book. I find that amusing. Now, you mentioned the Quakers. And I've always thought, oh, what nice people the Quakers were. But you tell us that in the late 1650s, Quaker missionaries were legally banned from entering Massachusetts. And if they did, they would get whippings, imprisonment, and if they were repeat offenders, execution.
Yeah, and that speaks more to, the Quakers may have been perfectly nice, but it speaks more to the intolerance of the New England Puritans and the early Yankee experience. The Puritans, who were Calvinists, thought that they were on a holy mission. They've been sent to the New England wilderness, put a light on a hill, an errand in the wilderness, create a more perfect society as per their interpretation of John Calvin. And the Quakers were not part of that. They represented a threat. Their teachings were contrary to the mission that the Yankees believed God had tasked them with. So yeah, they were intolerant of many people. Most people had the wisdom to stay out of the way and avoid the Yankee states. But the Quakers were, in England as well, the Quakers were often, putting forward their ideas and not standing down even when they were being punished for it. They were sort of dissenters. And so that nuisance of the Quakers not conforming and going around saying unorthodox ideas led Massachusetts to come down very hard on them. And similarly, the same things were happening in England, which is why so many Quakers had left to go to William Penn's utopian experiment, where Quakers and anybody else could practice their religion freely and openly, and there wouldn't be any one religion in charge, which in the 17th century was a really radical idea.
Well, what you were just talking about, and I mentioned about the Quakers and Puritan founders, you have a chapter called Belonging, and that's where this comes from. So after you tell us how the Quakers were treated in Massachusetts, you also mentioned something about, speaking of immigration, something that made me admire Henry Ford. And do you know what I'm referring to?
One thing.
Well, yeah. Well, maybe he was a nice guy, but he probably had his own interest. That when most of the Deep Southern and Greater Appalachian states made programs for immigrants illegal, what did Henry Ford do in Michigan?
Yeah, so Michigan's part of that greater Yankee space, right? The greater New England. The first people who settled Michigan were either lumberjacks coming from the place that had invented 19th century industrial lumbering techniques, Maine, or in the sort of, the townspeople and the movers and shakers who were developing the institutions and sitting in the territorial legislature and the state constitutional assembly, and later the governors and the legislators were all from the Yankee settled Western Reserve of Ohio, the Yankee settled upstate New York, and New England itself, which had provided five of the first six territorial governors. So Michigan has this Yankee attitude towards immigration. And the attitude is basically, sure, you can come here, but you have to become like us. You must assimilate. This is a melting pot. If you don't assimilate, it's a threat to the mission, whatever it is, right? And so that requirement that people come learn these ways and assimilate into the norms of the dominant Yankee culture is why, Yankees were very insistent on creating public schools across the frontier where immigrant children would be assimilated and taught to become good Yankees and so on. So what Henry Ford did in his factories, he needed lots of immigrant labor, but he also created these night schools to make sure that the immigrants in the great immigration wave of the late 19th and early 20th century, who were not Protestant generally, Jewish, Catholic, Orthodox Christians from Eastern Europe and elsewhere, who were considered alien and strange. Many people thought that they couldn't be good Republican citizens, that Catholics would take their orders from the Pope. And that was a trope that went on even to when Kennedy was running for office in the 1960s. This was an alarming phenomenon, and everyone was all worried about it in Protestant America. But Henry Ford's solution was he sent all of his workers to free night school where they would be taught to be proper Americans. Here's how in America we hold our, knife and fork. Here's how we dress. Here's how we behave. And he'd have this graduation ceremony at the end when they'd completed the course, where all the family of all of the immigrant workers would be invited, and the teachers had this gigantic melting pot, and they were standing at the top of the melting pot, like on a raised platform, stirring it with giant wooden spoons, and from the stage right, all of the immigrant graduates would start walking behind the melting pot wearing their, Hungarian national costume, Slovak national costume, German, national costume, whatever it was. And they would change behind it while the stirring was going on, and then emerge stage left wearing identical American, in quote, suits. And the crowd goes wild, right? So it's a celebration of assimilation.
Accepting
that people can come, but it isn't like you can keep your own culture. Whereas if you went just south into the Midlands, the William Penn Quaker legacy zone, the idea is, everyone can come and you can keep your culture forever. Mm. I mean, like to the point where you can have your own village Danish person or Amish person or Mennonite person or somebody from some strange German Pietist sect with a dialect of German no one else can understand. You can come set up your schools, set up your newspaper, publish it in your language, teach in your language, and keep on going because no one's in charge, and that's fine. We share a shared political space, but we're supposed to retain our culture. So it's literally culturally pluralistic, with an assumption that nobody should assimilate. So that you can imagine how different those attitudes are, and imagine cramming them into the same state, like in somewhere like Ohio or Pennsylvania.
My guest is Colin Woodard, and his book is Nations Apart, How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, bestselling author Colin Woodard. And he was just telling us, for example, one of these nations, Yankeedom, newcomers were meant to melt into the existing culture. So that's what you were just telling us about. Now, you also, I mentioned people that we are familiar with, Henry Ford, for example. And then you quote Benjamin Franklin. And one thing I always wish Benjamin Franklin had been successful at, he wanted to revise the spelling of English. English words are just spelled from their historic origins. And so he had something to say about language, as I wasn't surprised he would have something to say, but I was surprised at what he said. Do you remember what you have a rather long quote by Benjamin Franklin about few of the children in the country learn English, he complained to an English friend in 1753.
Yeah, he finds it really frustrating. I think the quote goes on to say that, you know, it'll end up in the absurd situation where our legislators will need to have a German translator to translate for their colleagues for them. But the thing to remember with Ben Franklin is he was born and raised in Yankeedom and then moved to Philadelphia. So this whole Midlands model of, yeah, everyone can speak their own language and sure, we'll have translators, that was not a good norm for him. He was bothered by the whole thing. And so, yeah, he wanted everyone to conform. You know, we can't have this cultural chaos, but that's the Yankee in him talking. For most people in the Midlands, that was all fine and not particularly bothering them. But yeah, it would definitely irk a Yankee. And remember, New England at that time was incredibly homogenous. I mean, it's like entirely English and almost entirely, you know, Calvinist. Whereas the Midlands was staggeringly diverse. At the time of the Revolution, it had a German, not a British plurality, which is pretty amazing, and, you know, zillions of religions. So it's the clash of a homogenous monoculture, somebody from a homogenous monoculture living within a highly pluralistic city and regional culture.
And I think that's not something that's made clear when we're growing up and studying history in our schools. We don't learn these things that are in your book. And this is why I was so glad to read your book. When you were describing these cultures, I'm calling them cultures, these nations.
Yeah, regional cultures or nations, either
regional
one's
cultures.
Fine.
There's also a term that I don't know that I've ever had the need to use this word, but ethno-nationalistic definition of the United States. And this word comes up a lot, and I never realized it was a handy word to know. But you say this ethno-nationalistic definition of the United States was dominant federation-wise through the 1960s, that this idea of ethno-nationalist, and then often you follow that word with authoritarianism. Ethno-nationalistic authoritarianism. And why is this phrase a handy one to know?
Well, you've touched on what has been the central battle of our shared experience as a as a federation. You know, the United States brought these different regional cultures together, and it came together in an accident of history. Each of these colonies was threatened by a change in British imperial policy in the 1770s that was going to force them all to conform and lose their local power ways and, you know, cultural ways of doing things. And they all ganged together to protect each of their own ways of doing things in a ragtag alliance. And lo and behold, they won. They blew up the Death Star. But that meant that they suddenly found themselves in something called the United States of America. And nobody knew what that was. You know, is it an EU? Is it a NATO alliance? Is it supposed to be a centralized nation state like the Prussians have? Nobody knew in the 1770s or even in the 1789 when we're writing the Constitution or in 1800. In fact, not until the 1830s was when the country was starting to crack apart over slavery and other issues. There'd been secession movements, New Englanders considering leaving during the War of 1812, parts of Appalachia wanting to break off and form their own country during the Whiskey Rebellion and so on. Everyone knew that this United States thing was gonna fall apart if they didn't come up with a story as to what a shared United States identity was. Because in the 1830s, if you asked somebody, hey, what country are you from? They would have said, I'm a Massachusettsian, I'm a South Carolinian, not I'm a United Statesian. And so this was really complicated because everyone knew that they didn't have a shared history, ethnicity, religion, shared political ideas. They were in this space together. So there was a battle that started in the 1830s over what the soul, the definition of the United States was going to be, what it meant to be an American, not a South Carolinian or a New Hampshirean. And that battle quickly took, in real time, two sides formed. The first argument was, well, we're a people devoted to the mission statement that was put forward in our first statement as a people, the Declaration of Independence, that we're a people tasked with trying to make the natural rights promises in the Declaration a reality. We're going to try to create a society where people all have, every single person, a natural right given to them by God or the universe to live, to not be tyrannized, to pursue happiness as you understand it, and to access a representative self-government that will make it all possible. And, you know, Americans will try to create the first society where individuals can be universally free and sustainable over time, was the argument. And that was immediately countered in real time by a second argument coming out of a group of deep Southern intellectuals who said explicitly, no way, the Declaration's completely wrong. Humans are not equal and obviously aren't. In fact, only the superior Anglo-Saxon race has the genius to secure the ideals in the Declaration. We're a classical republic, like ancient Greece or Rome, they argued, where a tiny minority at the top of the pyramid has the liberty or privilege to practice democracy and subjugation and slavery of the natural lot of the many. In other words, we're the ethnostates of the Anglo-Saxon race and everybody else is here provisionally. And at the time, they had 2,000 years of history and political philosophy behind them. And this other liberal democratic idea was the radical new one. That was immediately the battle. That was the meta struggle of the antebellum period and the Civil War, Reconstruction, Southern Redemption, the Jim Crow period, the Civil Rights Movement. And it's our struggle today. It's sort of the eternal battle. And the ethno-national one, in other words, defining nationhood in some way through bloodlines. It started as Anglo-Saxon supremacy, Anglo-Protestant, it kept shifting around. But the point is that some people, by dint of their intrinsic characteristics and bloodlines, do not belong, even if they're born here, versus a civic nationalism, which says what we have in common as Americans is a devotion to a set of founding ideals. And that it's those ideals that draw us together. So that's been the battle. And you're correct that there was a fight, and that fight continued long after the Civil War, with no side being dominant until the first federation-wide consensus, and that was in the 1910s and 1920s, and that was around an ethno-national definition. Especially at the climax was during Woodrow Wilson's presidency, the first deep Southern president who segregated the federal government, who presided over a period when Birth of a Nation was the rage, a film literally celebrating the KKK's terrorist campaign to roll back the political emancipation of African Americans in the South, when we were putting up most of the Confederate monuments that we were until recently tearing down. And when the 1924 Immigration Act was created, an immigration act that set ethno-racial quotas, severe ones, to ensure the Anglo-Protestant character of the United States would be restored. That was the specific purpose of the bill. And so, I mean, that was a difficult period. The civic national story, the American experiment, the idea that we're devoted to the Declaration, the ideals in it, that didn't become the Federation-wide consensus until the civil rights movement of the 1960s. So, you know, and that's when, you know, from a political scientist's perspective, the United States first became a liberal democracy, small L, small D, a Western democracy, in, you know, not in the 1860s, in living memory in the 1960s. You know, it's an incredible accomplishment that had to be fought for and continues to have to be fought for.
My guest is Colin Woodard, and in his book, Nations Apart, he attempts to make sense of the regional divides in this country, in North America, but in this country in particular. Now, you have a quote in your book that I found shocking, even though I understand, because it was a quote by the Vice President of the Confederate States, Alexander Stephens, and he refers to the premise of human equality as faulty. You say, Alexander Stephens said, faulty premise of human equality, and even though he was a Confederate, it still, I found that shocking.
They were very explicit, the Confederacy, that their purpose was to defend the slave system and white supremacy. Like, that's an official speech of his. There are many others, but that was the whole motivation for creating a Confederate States of America.
There are many sections of your book I read and reread, just like I studied the maps and look in the graphics in your book. Also, you quote Mark Twain, Sir Walter Raleigh was in great measure responsible for the war. Sir Walter Scott.
Yeah. Author of Ivanhoe and those other novels.
You have children read Ivanhoe in school, and yet Mark Twain is saying Sir Walter Scott was responsible for the Civil War?
Well, he's referring to the effect that Ivanhoe and some of Sir Walter Scott's other novels had on the Southern planter aristocracy. They read those books, and the books argued that there was a clash in England with the great invasion of 1066, when the Normans invaded England across the English Channel and confronted the Saxons and defeated them, and, you know, created a sort of hybrid culture of Normans from France who were aristocratic and had Roman Empire legacy ideas about order, you know, freedom as a privilege or a liberty provided to the few and bequeathed as an honor, versus the Saxons, who in Sir Walter Raleigh's description in his books were people who believed they were freeborn people, that everyone had at least certain people, that the Anglo-Saxons were freeborn people who had the right to be free from birth and would fight for it. And the planter aristocracy took these books, which celebrated the Normans' point of view, that the sophisticated civilization-bearing Normans had to, you know, sort of defeat and lord over the crude Anglo-Saxons. They saw that reflected in their imaginations for the United States and started taking on the idea that they, the planters of the South, were the descendants of the Normans, and that the Yankees and the Northerners were all the crude swamp-dwelling Saxon people who needed to be subjugated, right? It was a pro-aristocracy argument for the glamour of the, you know, the upper class and its sophisticated ways over the crude and filthy peasants, the civilization bearers. So yeah, they embraced that, and Twain recognized that that's what had happened, and assigned blame for the Civil War to that, in that the aristocrats were encouraged to start developing an image and a fable that they were indeed descended from lofty lines. The reality is that most of the planters were descended from people who'd moved to Barbados and become staggeringly wealthy, but had started with nothing and were rapacious and won a vicious and horrible struggle that lasted generations on Barbados, you know, made the most, the person who's willing to create the most sugar at the cost of human lives would win the game. But that was not the way the mythos of the Southern plantation aristocracy played out.
Well, I mentioned that your book for me was personal because I began understanding a lot that I did not understand when I was growing up in the Deep South. My great-grandfather fought for the Union, but my dad moved to this little town in the South, and it didn't occur to me at the time to wonder, how come there are all these mansions, these huge houses where the third floor is a ballroom, and this one particular street where all these mansions were? And I didn't really make that connection as to how this happened to be. I was shocked when I moved to California many years ago to learn how the Civil War was fought here in California, so to speak, because I thought it all took place in the South. But you say that there was a KKK in California after the Civil War. The Ku Klux Klan was in California after the Civil War.
The KKK was almost everywhere in the early 20th century. So there's the first Klan, and the first Klan was primarily motivated to restore white supremacy and, you know, to stop African Americans from holding office or voting or anything else, to roll things back to the condition before the Union armies had won and occupied the region. But then there was a second Klan, and that Klan came in reaction to Birth of a Nation. That film, that blockbuster film, which was filmed, of course, in California, was so enormously influential that it actually rallied people to create a second Klan. And it grew in the 1920s to have millions and millions and millions of members. And it was everywhere. It was here in my home state of Maine, where I live. It was in California and elsewhere. And it was in the North, it was motivated. There were, say, in Maine, there were almost no people of color at all in Maine. Yeah. But the animus was directed towards people who weren't Anglo-Protestant, in other words, the Catholics. In Maine, we had large numbers of Quebecois immigrants moving to the industrial working class, were often immigrants from Quebec, which borders on Maine. And so they were the targets, you know, people burning down Catholic churches and stuff. I don't know the details of the history in California, but it would not surprise me if it was geared against Latino people and Catholics as well.
After a break, Colin Woodard and I will be back to continue our conversation about his newest book, Nations Apart: How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, New York Times bestselling author Colin Woodard, and his newest book is Nations Apart: How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. So a lot of what I'm reading in your book makes me realize the label you sometimes use, origin myths. And I think, oh my gosh, I never knew how much of what I thought was history were myths. And when I was in junior high, when they started having us write essays about the heroes of not the Civil War, we were instructed not, well, they didn't say, don't say Civil War. What they said was, use the phrase war between the states.
Yes.
And we were specifically instructed to say that. And it wasn't until I read your book that phrase, war between the states, was used by Alexander Hamilton.
You had, he was worried back in the revolutionary period, and when we were trying to draft our Constitution, Hamilton's arguments for promoting the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, and Federalist number 10, I think it is, he said that one of the most important things about creating a new Constitution that will bind the states together more tightly and create a more centralized government is if we don't that he was worried that they would fall into war with one another, and that this civil war would be more horrible and destructive than the wars of Europe. So that, you know, there was a concern there, even in the 1780s and 1790s, that if we didn't stick together, that we were not naturally friends. And so that was one of the powerful arguments.
And another thing, too, we kind of suppose that, well, the South lost the Civil War, therefore things changed because they lost the war. But in the mid-20th century, we were having the United Daughters of the Confederacy were sponsoring these essay contests where we wrote about the glories of our Confederate heroes. And it really made me think, golly, everybody should read this book. Now, I don't know. I can't imagine your book being required in schools, but I think, yeah, that I like the idea.
Yeah. American Nations actually is in a lot of schools at the high school level and in university because it, you know, brings a lot of strands together. I mean, you can't make sense of the country if you don't know these things. Many people don't, but you know, how is it that the Union won the Civil War? So why did we have to have a civil rights movement? I mean, if you try to airbrush out Reconstruction, the failure of Reconstruction, the Klan's successful terrorist campaign, you're making history incomprehensible through those deletions. So it's, you know, it's only through understanding the whole sweep of history that you can make sense of it and, you know, hopefully move beyond it.
And you mentioned a word that I didn't know the origin of, the word lynch. I hadn't thought about it, but there were lynchings. I did know that. But how did we get the word lynch into our language?
Yeah, well, there was a fellow going around in the Appalachian zone, Colonel Lynch, who was doing extrajudicial killings, and that's where the term came from. So it has a sort of a regional origin. But that was part of the, you know, remember, all through, even after the Civil War, in several regions of the country, there were created essentially ethnostates where you had a formal racial apartheid system backed by law and death squads. And the death squads were often, the members would include, you know, judges and sheriffs and people who were supposed to be protecting the law and the Constitution. So, I mean, that's the opposite of a Western democracy or liberal democracy or the values in the Declaration. And that, again, was the norm up until the 1960s. So if you think about that legacy, you know, we have a large chunks of the country that are young democracies, right? They, at a state level, they had been one-party authoritarian states in these respects. And that means, you know, young democracies are often weaker and can be subject to backsliding. So you can see that in the regional geography of the country now.
My guest is New York Times bestselling author Colin Woodard, and his book is Nations Apart, How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. And you have different topics that we've been covering, some that I particularly was interested in, but you have chapters on gun control, immigration, health policy, abortion, climate change. We've been mainly talking about history. And then authoritarianism and democracy. Authoritarianism. And golly, you do give us hope, though.
Indeed.
You tell us that, but what do you cover in your chapter on authoritarianism?
Right. Well, if you have the ethno-national tradition, the tradition that the country belongs to people with the right bloodlines, however those are defined, in a diverse country, you can't have an ethno-national system without being authoritarian, because you're denying rights to and suppressing a large number of people who don't belong to your in-group, as the Germans would say, your Herrenvolk. Yeah. And, you know, those people, you know, it could be in a majority of the people in some circumstances. So you can only do that through terrible violence and draconian laws and being an authoritarian ruler. So that's one tradition. And then you have the civic tradition, which is devoted to the idea that everyone has these inborn and equal moral rights to survive and to participate in politics and to pursue their happiness and to not be tyrannized. And so those two traditions are definitely at odds with one another, and they're regionally focused because the ideology of ethno-nationalism, which came out of the slave societies of the Deep South and Tidewater, has a very deep legacy, and the civic, and it clashes with the civic tradition. So that's been a fight that we have had throughout our history.
Hi, yeah, this is a really interesting subject, and I was wondering if you have any lessons that could be learned from history, because there's always been large kind of nations that are comprised of different groups that have happened throughout history, the Roman and Byzantine empires in Europe, and even like the Aztec Empire, in what's now Mexico. It seems that usually it's the big and powerful that try to join these nations. What happens to the rest of us when these nations fall apart?
Like when you have a multi-ethnic empire and a multi-ethnic empire falls apart?
Yes, exactly.
The collapse of empires, and it's happened throughout history, is often quite messy. What happens if you have a multi-ethnic or multinational state, the Habsburg Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and so on, and it collapses? Well, then you have these rump states that form, and if they're going to define themselves based on a national identity that's been previously, denied to them, the Austrians versus the Serbs versus the Hungarians versus the Slovaks versus the Czechs, then that's an ethno-state division that happens. And the lines are often messy. Not everybody who lives in a particular, if you take a pencil and draw it around a map, not everybody inside your lines is going to be of one ethnicity. What's the status of the people who are of the wrong ethnicity, the non-Hungarians in Hungary, the non-Slovaks in Slovakia, or who don't have the right religion, and that can end up with purges and population transfers and oppressions of various sorts. But also the fracturing results in unstable new power dynamics as the different new countries who may not trust each other and may have historical grievances are facing off against one another in a new balance of power. So a lot of people say to me, hey, if you've described all of these regional differences, wouldn't it be easier if our federation just came apart? And I always argue, no, it'd be much better if we stay together and we stick together around the defending the American experiment and the ideas in the Declaration, because I spent my 20s as a foreign correspondent in Eastern Europe and the Balkans during the transition period, when there were all kinds of demagogues out there using this kind of historical legacy. They had the collapse of the Soviet Empire, and suddenly these countries could decide their own destinies and argue about their histories and decide who belonged and who didn't, and you ended up with the Yugoslav War and the Bosnian genocide. No, those are bad things. My read of the human condition is it's way risky to just assume that were we to try to break up the United States into its separate regions in some way, that it would result peacefully. I mean, hopefully it would. I don't have that same faith. I think that's a path to be avoided. But even if it was peaceful and we broke up, suddenly North America would be another continent of great power rivalries, except we wouldn't be one of the great powers because we wouldn't exist anymore. The great powers out there in the globe, if the United States is taken off the map and turns into 4, 6, 8, 10 different countries, the powers in the world are going to be the authoritarian ones, Russia and China particularly. And you'll have the different powers backing one or another of the North American rump states. And I mean, it's a recipe for instability here and global instability, because my time as a foreign correspondent all over the world and as a scholar of international relations, the United States says, there's many things we have done badly in the world or gotten wrong, but when the United States isn't around, things often get quite a bit worse. And so without the United States there, I fear for what kind of world we would live in. So those are all arguments that we should try to hold this together. We succeeded in holding these regional cultures together for two centuries and became a prosperous, wealthy, and for a time the only superpower in the entire world. So clearly something can work there, but we have to bring ourselves together around the one thing that most of us do indeed hold in common, and that's the American experiment and the idea that America should be defined by being a place trying to make the Declaration's promises a reality. And my project, I run a think tank project that a lot of the work in Nations Apart comes from. It's called Nationhood Lab. It's at the Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy at Salve Regina University in Rhode Island. And one of the things we did is extensive polling on national story, on the competing ethno-national definitions of the U.S. and the ones linked to the Declaration. And the Declaration, the civic nationhood, is overwhelmingly the favorite of, you know, of Americans, you know, like a 60-30 margin. And if you just ask Americans, hey, you know, do you agree or disagree that we as Americans are duty-bound to protect one another's, you know, natural rights in the Declaration, you know, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, it came out 97-2 in favor. Which is, you don't get 97-2 margin on any question. It's like the widest margin our pollsters had ever seen in an answer to a question. If you ask Americans, you know, is the earth round or flat? And the Pew Research Center has, it's 80-10 with 10% undecided. So 97-2 is like loaves and fishes territory. So what I'm saying is, but there is something in our subconscious that we do have in common. Most Americans intrinsically think that the Declaration is what we're about, but we've just stopped talking about it. Our leaders don't know how to talk about it. We, you know, people lack the historical clarity and the civic education to even know what the battle is about. They see there's a problem, but we need to be speaking with clarity about what our country's real purpose is and why ethno-nationalism is contrary to the American experiment itself. So that's the work that we do at Nationhood Lab, and that Nations Apart sort of concludes with in the last chapter, describing all this backed by polling data.
I'm happy that you have a bit of optimism regarding everything that's going on. So what would you like to leave us with that you think is really important from your book, Colin?
Well, I think the most important thing is that we are in a crisis. It is real and the stakes are enormous. You know, we're sliding towards dictatorship, and that would be a really bad thing for everybody. But within that context, you know, there is hope in that most people don't want to slide down into that world. And most people actually agree, if you ask them, with those promises in the Declaration. We need to reorient ourselves and our politics around that as a guiding star, because that's what holds the vast majority of us together. And I'm optimistic that if we do that, we can survive this period and, you know, rejuvenate our ideals and have the country carry on for another 250 years.
Well, on that note, I'm going to thank you so much, Colin Woodard. And your book is Nations Apart, How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America.
Thank you so much.
Listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.